Hello and good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Event Horizon. It's me and a very good friend of mine tonight. Marty isn't with us, sadly, but we're still going to have fun. So, my friend, would you like to sign yourself in?
Hi, John. John Foote. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, John. Okay, we're going to have a really great show. Now, as I'm going to briefly say this, happy birthday, Star Trek. We wish you were here to see it, Eugene, but your son is, so I'm sure it's being remembered. 50 years ago, Star Trek. Who would have thought it, huh?
Busy weekend. Glenn's into it, too.
Yeah.
Evening, Glenn. Optronics. Black Projects.
Yep. Hi, guys. Hi, Starstorm. Nice to see you there. And, it's been a long time. Of course, it was the franchise they tried to kill off. I suppose we should admit to that. CBS did try to kill it.
I'm sure they did.
Tavi! Welcome, Tavi, to the chat room. Tavi. Nice to see you.
Oh, my heart's pounding a million miles an hour. Bum, 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 bum. You know what I liked about Star Trek, Nick?
Yeah.
Right? Here's what I liked about it. It encouraged a lot of people to get into science.
It did.
It did. It just did. It did what it did. It kept me as a kid excited. Right? I really loved it. Mm-hmm. I did. I had dreams where I thought I could reach out and grab it and get a hold of it, and they'd have me out in space. They'd have to take me inside, right?
Yep.
And then I'd have to go with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd be off into space. Oh, it was imaginations.
Well, in some
ways. But it opened up a lot of imaginations. And the Big Bang Theory is like that today, you know that?
Yes, it is.
It really encourages this generation.
And I have to admit, I think that Gene Roddenberry's optimism was excellent. He really did go where no man has gone before. If you think about it,
Lucille Ball plays a big role in that too.
Yes, she did.
You got to thank Lucy for this. I mean, yeah, she plays a big part. Well, there's stories where she's right down on the set with everybody trying to get it done.
Yeah,
just trying to get the props put in place. No money.
Yeah,
but a dream, man.
Of course, the thing is, Lucy owned Desilu Studios, which made Star Trek. Ironically, it was Lucy who saved the show. If it hadn't been for Lucille Ball, Star Trek would never go off.
Definitely. She played a big role in it.
Yeah. She
but
saved
it's exciting. Now, the whole weekend is different versions of the Star Treks.
Yeah. Still can't get my head around the movies, the new ones.
Oh, yeah. They're good. They're not just for us, right? For the next year.
I know. But,
evening, Tavi.
Let's say.
Optronics, that is Tavi.
Yes.
Tavi, that is Optronics. He's from down south.
Argentina, I think.
Yes.
Way down south. But yes, it's great. We actually have one of the Deep Sky Divas in chat with us tonight. Now we must be cooking on gas.
we have quite a few articles to cover tonight, too.
Yes, we
Any
have.
Any idea where we'd like to go?
Ooh.
We had a few things. We got some rockets lifting off. We got to cover those.
Yes. India has had another successful launch.
Yep.
That's always great. It's nice to see other nations joining the space club, because it isn't just the three. It's now the four, the five. Who knows? It could be six, seven, or eight countries who could also now be the prime movers in man getting to Mars, to Jupiter, to Saturn. Maybe even if we're really lucky, we will get the Pegasus and built finally, and we will do a grand tour of the solar system with a human crew. Now, that would be something awesome, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think I'll be sticking around to see it. Good luck to the generations that do. I mean, if you got the radio on old time, it would have to be really, really old time.
Yeah.
And then that'd be us way back then talking about what it would be like to travel around the solar system.
Yeah. And, of course, for the guys who made it happen, it was old-time radio that it got them enthused. It was Buck Rogers. It was Flash Gordon. it's just amazing. And, of course, having said that, two modern Buck Rogers alumni have appeared in Star Trek, believe it or not. Gil Gerard turned up in Star Trek The New Voyages playing a Commodore. And guess who turns up in Star Trek Continues?
Well, I didn't know who the first guy was, so I bet I'm not going to be able to guess the second one, Nick.
Well, the first guy was, he played the modern Buck Rogers on TV.
Ah.
Back in the 80s. The 80s, yes.
Hello, Buck. Yeah. That guy.
Yeah, that guy. Okay. And, of course, Erin Gray turns up in Star Trek Continues, also playing a Starfleet Commodore. So it's great fun. It just goes to show that you've got great continuity. And, of course, we're not going to forget the immortal Buster Crabbe turns up in the 1980s Buck Rogers as well, playing Brigadier Gordon. So we all know who he was. But, yeah, we got some really great stories. Should we go for Moonshine first?
Monster Moonshine? Not really.
Not really?
You really want to go for Monster Moonshine? That's math.
Why not? It's great.
I've got to cover the multiverse problem.
Sure.
And why it's a problem. But how it's got us to the point now where we're dealing with this multiverse?
Mm-hmm.
Super Symmetry didn't show up at the LHC yet. Okay? And that changed this summer. And this is not a subject you can start throwing around going, well, Super Symmetry is not there, blah, blah, blah. This requires a little bit of sensitivity.
Yeah.
Okay, this requires a grown-up conversation. Science took a big step forward this summer in the fact that there is no supersymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, supersymmetry was a web that blended a lot of problems, not problems, but a lot of things that have to be dealt with, like the Higgs boson, why it's so light, fine structure constant, why it's so light, whether or not it could handle the questions between, say, nuclear and gravity, the difference in the strengths there. I mean, we're talking a million, billion, trillion difference.
Yeah.
And for the fine structure constant, you have to say a trillion three times. A trillion, 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 trillion. Sorry, 10 times. So use your fingers. Keep saying a trillion 10 times. And at the end of that last trillion, you're going to put these little numbers, 138. And they're all zeros. It starts with a zero, and they're all zeros.
Yeah.
Physics predicted a different number, 120 orders of magnitude difference. Physics predicted these numbers, the fine structure constant, the Higgs. The Higgs come in at 125 GeV.
Mm-hmm.
Or 1.25 TeV.
Yeah.
Okay? When gravity couples to the Higgs, it has to get rid of a million, billion, trillion electron volts.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's done, all that's left of that little Higgs 0.125 TeV.
Mm-hmm.
Now, supersymmetry had relationships between other particles that would play these seesaw mechanism or tug of war and balance out these equations. When supersymmetry does not show up, these equations, which were all blended together through this supersymmetric mesh, really beautiful subject, the mesh started to evaporate and people were left on islands. So the best guess scenario that people wanted to throw out was, it's a multiverse. We live in a multiverse. We have these low, low numbers, these unbelievable low, low numbers, because those just happen to be the numbers that they are. And so every universe has a different set of numbers. And we just happen to inhabit the universe that has these sets of numbers. Because if the Higgs was any bit different, the matter wouldn't be able to form. You wouldn't get the stars. You don't get stars, you're not going to get people.
True.
And if the fine structure constant was even 10% difference, all those zeros I mentioned, the universe would fly apart. The universe is so finely tuned, it's called, whether or not it was natural or naturalness, it's fine-tuned. It's almost too perfect. It is. It's too perfectly balanced. It's called improbable.
Mm-hmm.
And these other particles, this supersymmetric relationship, explained how this balance wouldn't be there because there's other particles we don't see, and yet they're yet to discover at the LHC. Well, the partners didn't show up. They didn't show up at LEP, and they didn't show up at the Tevatron, and they're not showing up at the LHC. And this is a conversation we had since 2010, given a heads up. Like, if supersymmetry does not show up, what's the next step? And there's been some exciting finds in physics since then, right?
Yeah.
I mean, physics is not the end. Physics has to answer these questions itself. If you run to the multiverse, there is no more physics. Physics doesn't have, physics can't tell us why these numbers are so low, why we got the constants we have. And that's not right, because physics always has told us why we have what we have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, physics is a part of the natural world, as part of the universe that we've known about. We observe and measure, behaviors and predictions of energy and matter and how it moves in the coordinate system, all within their personal reference frame. And physics covers a section of it. Math covers a section of it. And math and physics work together this time, and that may be what has happened. Math and every time physics has predicted something, it's discovered math has already been there, which is great because math is so amazing. This time, math and physics went together, and it predicted partners that weren't there. Now, where did supersymmetry come from? If nature doesn't use it, we can't say, well, the universe just doesn't like it. You know, that's fine. You know, it didn't have to be there. Where did the supersymmetry come from? Did we learn something really unique about the universe, or are we starting to learn something really unique about the human mind? Mm-hmm. And neural networking. And it's really an interesting time. It's not an end of physics time like is being portrayed, I guess.
Yeah.
By some. It's very exciting. But there's nothing to give the next generation saying, okay, now here's your supersymmetry, and here's where you're going to be searching for your particles because we're going to need the next experiment for this. This time, the graduate students in university right now are going, got nothing for you guys.
Mm.
Come up with something. This is the best time. There's no more follow the leader. The supersymmetry had to be checked. It's been around since the 70s and the 60s, right? It just took so long to get it to a point where you say, wow, it just might not be here.
Mm.
Now, again, only 1% of the data the LHC is going to collect over its lifetime has been collected so far.
Yeah.
But it's enough data now to go, okay, it's not showing up. At least the minimalist one, called minimal supersymmetric, that's not showing up. And it was the easiest ones that you would find. Mm-hmm. You know, the particles would be there because this is the most basic way the equations fall out. But if supersymmetry is broken, ouch. Mm-hmm. Like the electroweak symmetry broken, if we're dealing with the same type of relationship in the supersymmetric range, at another higher scale, supersymmetry holds.
Yeah. Okay?
But at the scales we're trying to probe the LHC, it's not there. So there is no super partners interfering with our partners. They're just the particles we have, they just happen to be just what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's a whole lot of more physics to go with it. And I'm of the ones that says there's a whole lot more physics to go with it.
Now, I do know that person has already lost a bet on supersymmetry. Now, as I remember,
whole group of them, yeah.
Yeah, basically the prize was a very expensive bottle of cognac.
$150. Nima, yeah, you talked about the Nima?
Yeah.
Nima Akarni Hamid. Yeah, I like Nima. See, Nima had he had split supersymmetry. I've been a Nima fan for a while because I'm that generation, okay? And Nima's Canadian, and so I followed Nima. Yeah, you know, like people say, well, you just follow Nima because you like the way he talks stuff. Or, I always liked his subjects. You know, I found him very inspirational. And I like how David Gross, he's always with David Gross. And he's exciting. He's like Mumwala, a sheriff Mumwala. He's exciting. And Nima's always had creativity. He's Little Higgs. Split supersymmetry, it was easy for someone like me to catch on to. I'm not a physicist. I'm not trained in this stuff. This is just a hobby, right? It's been a hobby for a long time, unfortunately, or fortunately. And so it was easy following Nima and even into the amplitudehedron stuff now.
Yeah.
And his split supersymmetry put the Higgs in the 126 range, between 126 and 120 GeV. And this is what you and I used to talk about back before 2010, Nick.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the 125 GeV. We drove everybody nuts with that, okay?
Yeah, we did.
But there was the models I was following. Lock, 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 okay?
Yeah.
So when the 125 come in, and John Baez, right, he put out a lot of work. He put out the modeling, the software, and you got to play with everything. And it was a really exciting time around 2011. And so even though I come in on the numbers, right, I know now I wasn't right. We were right. The numbers were right, you know. And so when I said, I was just going to come in at 125, it's because of the models I was following. But the models that even I was following are incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's okay to be wrong. I don't mind. You know, It's okay to be wrong. It's great. It's okay to make mistakes. That's the best part. Failure is the best part of the subject, because without failing, you're not going to get anywhere. And failure is a subject that people say, oh, you can't afford to fail. Failure's not an option. Well, in science, failure is an option. Failure tells you something.
Well, I think the thing is, I think what people forget is they're all hooked on success after success. Without the failures, you don't really learn anything.
I mean, these neural networks, these brand new neural networks now,
yeah,
they thrive on failing right off the bat. But what you're actually doing in science is finding something that's not obviously wrong. You never get to the point where you found something right. If you get to the point where you find something that's obviously not wrong, you go, wow. You know, other people are going to help you find that now, because you've got a piece of the subject that's obviously not wrong.
Yeah.
And no, you're not right. And someone's going to show you why you're not right. But wow, are we ever going to find out something really unique? Like this fifth force they're talking about, we may bring that subject up. Is it wrong yet? Don't know. A perfect example of not being wrong, little piece of math. Fermat's last theorem, right? Ken Ribbett's in his office, and he's working on this subject, modular forms, elliptic curves. Just let the words go, okay? And anyway, in comes Garrett Fry, and he says, hey, look at this. If Fermat is wrong, I can write a curve, or if Fermat is correct, I can write a curve that's not elliptic. Okay, look, here's the little number. Two lines on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. It's obviously not wrong. And it brought the whole subject to a screeching halt, where everybody, whoa. And by proving those two lines that Gerhard Fry wrote down and gave to Ribbett, like just walking into his office, hey, Ken, how you doing? Look at this. Look what I just scribbled out. It was like, wow, it's obviously not wrong, and everybody has to stop and find out, because if he was right and that curve is right, then all of mass would have broke down as we know it at that time. And so what ended up happening was they proved Fry wrong. Fry's curve was wrong, and that way they proved Fermat, and they proved Fermat's last theorem. That was Richard Taylor.
Yeah.
With Andrew Wiles. Well, Andrew Wiles gets the credit, but there's a lot of people involved in that story. But that's a piece of obviously not wrong, and how powerful a piece of obviously not wrong changes everything. See, it was wrong. The curve was incorrect, but until they could destroy it and put a knife through it, it was very exciting, and it held everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody learned from it. And it brought a big section of maths together. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Nick.
I think you've hit it on the nail right there. Everybody's learned from it. We get so bound up in some things. We don't always quite see the trees for the wood, because we've got a very narrow focus, and that is the be all end all, and that is where we're going. Never mind that something may be happening that's just outside of our vision. When we do get it wrong, when we find that it's wrong, it's a case of, oh, and the vision opens up a little bit better, and you get to see perhaps a little bit more. Now, I know that right now supersymmetry is probably in a nosedive. Would you agree with that?
No. It's at the level. The reason why supersymmetry is still going to be important, it's a general conversation between subjects.
Okay.
Particle physicists can talk to mathematicians, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned that moonshine. That moonshine's a conversation between algebra, geometry, and number theory, with the along with string theory. It's a general conversation, and it's very important. That's a brand new area now. This conversation is, you don't have to be good at any one of these subjects, just understand some of the basics of it, and you can hear how these groups of people come together now in these conversations, like the Simon Center. They're putting on an amazing collection of this stuff now. And it's to bring together conversations of different areas. And this new generation is picking up this new conversation, and it's really, really different.
I'll be honest, I totally agree. And I think in the end, this new conversation is going to lead to perhaps the next series of advances, because we've we've done away with the we are hidebound to do it this way. That's what I see a lot of cases.
Well, everything's changed now. You can go after it. See, these mock modular forms, this moonshine and automorphic forms, it's a new language. And it involves number theory, and math is going to draw a lot of people in. And now that supersymmetry may ease up some on physicists, I don't know. But math has always been the strongest of the relationship between them. And there's a representation theory that matches a symmetry theory on one side. There's string theory on one side. There's number theory on the other. You're trying to find a way that string theory is talking to number theory. And string theory is quantum gravity, and number theory is numbers, mathematical relationships, functions. And that's what Susskind's just done with him and Melsina.
Mm-hmm.
You heard about that one yet?
That's one I haven't heard
the
about yet.
The black holes. They took the two black holes. They took two entangled particles, made black holes, and they made a wormhole between them. You didn't hear that one?
No, I didn't.
Wow.
But as I say, if that's the case, that in itself is a major step forward. If they created a wormhole between two black holes, is this?
Well, that's what Susskind's claim, and him and Melsina.
Yeah. So, is this a physical experiment or is this a theoretical?
This is Susskind, Leonard,
yeah.
Leonardo, right?
Yeah,
the old man. So him and Melsina. Well, Melsina, because we're going to saying hi to Argentina again tonight. Their thought experiment was taking Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen,
mm-hmm.
and their wormholes and the Rosen bridge.
Yep, I remember that.
So the conversation is Alice and Bob take these entangled particles, they separate, and what they do to one entangled pair affects another entangled pair. But if they both created black holes with their entangled pairs, they smash them together, creating black holes, and they have entangled black holes, and they have a wormhole between them. If this is correct, this will help bring together the two pieces, quantum mechanics and general relativity. It's really not about black holes, wormholes, and bridges. It's really about bringing together this equation, quantum mechanics and general relativity. That is what this automorphic forms, mock modular forms, and string theory is trying to do also. But Susskind and them may have found the equation that even Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen have been looking for.
Yeah.
That's the amazing part. Sean Carroll might have found one too, him and another group. But it would be really neat if Susskind is the one that found this equation that matches, that brings together general relativity and quantum mechanics in the same equation. That is the really exciting one.
Yeah, and it's been a long time coming because it's always been, I think, always been the dream to find a way to unite the two. And maybe...
Well, they meet at black holes, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I'm thinking maybe eventually we will perhaps get a theory of a grand unified theory of everything. The other thing Einstein was trying to do right up to his death was to find a way to bring everything together into one theory. So maybe this thought experiment with Susskind may be the beginnings of doing that.
Well, this relates to like the firewalls and information loss due to gravitational collapse.
Mm-hmm.
This 30-year conversation with Hawkins. And Hawkins has a different version of black holes, too, now.
Yeah.
So a lot of progress has been made on black holes in the last couple of years.
And I believe that there was one experiment going on in a lab that was claimed to have produced a form of Hawking radiation that may have been detectable. Now, I'm just trying to...
I remember something a long time ago. Yeah, I wouldn't...
Yeah. So, as I say...
It was representative of what Hawking radiation would be.
Yeah. So we're making a lot of steps forward suddenly that we're being dragged down into the morass.
Well, it's answering a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Well, if you can get these black holes, if this Einstein-Rosen, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen equation, you'll see it posted. If this will work... It's pretty cool, but what it's also stating is any particle is actually a wormhole between a gravity and like electromagnetism. You take these two sheets and a particle in between would be a wormhole. So you take these two sheets of space, and any particle would be a wormhole. So you put more particles together, and it would create the tunnel, right? But the tunnel requires this weird, really weird exotic matter called negative matter. And yeah. When they created these black holes in this time warp and the tunnel, it may be a solution. They may have found a solution to the negative matter part also, which is relatable to how information gets out of a black hole. So it's always, how does information get out of a black hole? How do you get in one? And how does quantum mechanics talk dealing with black holes? And how does general relativity talk? Because right now they both tell two different stories.
Yeah.
This story here, general relativity would emerge from quantum mechanics itself. Space-time itself would emerge from quantum mechanics.
Right. Now, I'm hoping, fingers crossed, this link works. Because whilst we were talking about it, I tried to Google the equation. Ah.
Which one? Einstein-Podolsky?
Einstein-Podolsky-Einstein-Rosen.
Yeah.
And, okay, yes, the link does actually work. So you just need to scroll down a wee bit in the link, and it's there. So that is what we're talking. Okay, ignore the.
I can't get to it. My browser, my antivirus won't let me anywhere near it.
Okay, let me just.
No problem.
I got a better link. I got a better version. Here we go. Now that I've opened it, let's find the chat room again. So many links. There we go. See, does that work for you, John?
There it is.
So that is the
E=mc². Is that what it is?
Well, no, this is the... you need to scroll down a little bit because...
faster than light, factor fiction. Fiction.
Yeah. It's Ke=m, my Greek, the zero dropped below the line. Brackets gamma minus 1 C 2 square equals M 0 C squared over 1 minus V 2 C over C 2
square. Oh, that's a beta root. Version, yeah. Mass relativistic, that's your mass at rest, 1 over 1 minus V squared over C squared.
That's it, yeah. That's it, yeah.
That's a gamma function, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so, all right. My description is probably be a bit ropey, but...
oh, no problem.
I tried to copy the link. Yeah, that's where I was at, because that is the actual Einstein-Rosen bridge equation. And I already, so, yes, that's it. Starstorm's got it. So it will definitely be in, it will be in the show notes, everybody. We got it. So anyway, that is the actual equation we were talking about. English, please. We are doing our best. Black projects, we're doing our best, but now that is the actual Einstein-Rosen bridge. The second link's a lot better, obviously, but I was trying for that little piece of information. I will save the actual image, and I will put it into the show notes. Well done. I've just been told it's been saved. And if you're looking at the Google page, you'll see the equation on one side and see some other representations for it. Relativity flies. Lorentzian wormholes, Nordic Schwarzschild wormholes, or Einstein-Rosen bridges. So I'll grab that one. Let me just open link in a new tab. That's probably the best way to do it. So... let me just get that.
I'll keep you busy. Want to timestamp this yet?
Oh, yes. Good point. It is the bottom half of the hour, and you are listening to the Event Horizon. It is 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You are listening to Nicky Vetz and... John?
Yeah, no, I'm right here. Yeah, sorry.
Okay, I was waiting for you to say something. Never mind. John Foote. Who, we are here without Marty this week, who's... doing other things. Okay, now where was I? Oh yes, I was putting that link into the chat. Okay,
where else did you want to head off to?
Well, I know you had some other stories you wanted to cover So what should we do? Should we go for...
I posted that core link.
Yeah. So yeah, let's go for that. Let's go for the core link.
This is... here, if I get this poster. This is a cryogenic. This is the coldest thing in the universe.
Even colder than space.
Yeah. It's an experiment designed to study the properties of neutrinos. In particular, the experiment looks for the rare phenomena called neutrinoless double beta decay. And that's really interesting. If neutrinoless double beta decay is detected, and this is an amazing experiment to try to do it, it will help answer how come there's more matter in the universe instead of antimatter.
Because if I remember correctly, at the time of the Big Bang, supposedly everything there was there should have been the equal amount of antimatter and matter, but for some reason matter came out on top.
Yep.
Now normally it would have just the reaction between matter and antimatter would have just annihilated. It would have been self annihilation.
It's called a baryonic asymmetry.
Thank you. And
supersymmetry had a solution for this also. Had a WIMP particle that would help with this.
Did the WIMP particle ever get found, though?
Nope. So this neutrinoless double beta decay, what happens is instead of emitting a neutrino, right, it skips and emits a pair of electrons.
Yeah.
It takes a, it skips and jumps. Now, neutrinos, if they are their own antimatter particle, instead of annihilating and disappearing, what was happening is they were producing electrons. So you're ending up with extra electrons. So you wound up with more electrons than anti-electrons. So at the end, you had more matter than antimatter.
Ooh.
That's why instead of the particles decaying and emitting neutrinos, it kept the neutrinos and it got rid of the energy by spitting out a pair of particles. Particles that weren't annihilating. They were hanging around.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong.
So if they had more particles hanging around, even the particles that were bumping into the antimatter, at the end of the argument, once all the matter and antimatter is done, you had this excess of particles.
Mm.
Because one of the rates at which these neutrinos and particles were being produced, instead of producing neutrinos and then annihilating neutrinos, then everybody annihilating, it was skipping a jump. This one process was skipping a jump.
Mm.
So by it skipping, instead of releasing antimatter and matter pairs, which would annihilate with other pairs, it just emitted a pair of electrons. Snuck extra matter out there.
Yeah.
Did that make sense?
It made sense to me.
Oh, good. All right, I didn't hear the fact.
No, seriously. In a lot of respects, this experiment is definitely very important because a lot of people still can't understand what is happening. And if this can actually give us the key to understanding why there is an abundance of matter over antimatter, or even better, why we exist in the universe.
Instead of just having one just because. This will be minus 217 degrees Celsius. And it's like 400 kilograms. So nothing this size has been that cold. Penzi and Wilson had the coldest one when they went and caught the radio background.
Yeah, and as I understand, it's a novel design. It's a detector made of towers of Rubik's cube-sized crystals of tellurium dioxide.
Well, this is it. All the parts that went into it all have a industrial application. So all this technology is will be exported out to industry.
Yeah.
Other cryo systems are going to be relying on this type of technology. Even that weather satellite that India's setting up had its own cryo system. It's the cryo systems right now, which are a nice little piece of technology all countries like to have on their own without having to rely on somebody else. It's a difficult piece of technology. Making stuff cold is not as easy as it sounds. And they have a, they can get stuff really, really cold. And cold is the future, right?
Yeah.
All quantum stuff's going to need cold. So there's a lot of applications where the technology that went into this satellite, or this set, that's not the satellite, sorry, this instrument.
Yeah.
And the crystals and how they grew the crystals. And these crystals, they have a, they simultaneously emit a pair of electrons. They're expensive in themselves.
Mm.
And a lot of people like to get them just for different types of experiments. They had to be built in China. The next ones, they want to try to build themselves.
Yeah. Now, I understand that the experiment sits about a kilometer beneath the tallest mountains of the Apennine Range in Italy. They're using the rock of the mountains to shield it from cosmic rays.
Not only that, they got the lead, too. Did you read about the lead? The lead come out of the sunken ships.
Yeah.
They dug out of the Mediterranean, so the ships are old. Because the lead, they need the oldest lead possible. Because yeah. New lead has contaminants in it.
Mm-hmm.
So they even got a hold, they even had to get a hold of that lead. Old lead is worth more than gold.
Oh, yeah. It always has been. That's why so many people risk life and limb to strip it off church roofs.
Oh, yeah. It's really in demand.
Yeah. So basically, the project is jointly supported by the Italian National Institute for Nuclear Physics and the Department of Energy's Office of Science and the National Science Foundation in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's a collaboration of 157 scientists from Italy, the U.S., China, France, and Spain. It's all based in the underground Italian facility called INFN. I am not going to try. My Italian is terrible, so I will not even go there. But having said that, again, this is...
It's nuclear research. Italian Nuclear Research Foundation.
Now, the important thing is it's an international collaboration. It transcends politics and national boundaries, which is I think is probably the best thing going. We're doing things for the right we're doing things perhaps in the right way. I will always say this: by the time we get to Mars, it will not be a single nation. It will be a multinational group. Because, to be honest, exploring the solar system is just too expensive for just one nation alone. But by everybody pitching in, not just financially, but with materials, personnel, it's the people, yeah.
Definitely the people. You need the people now, so you have to do cross-platform. Multination, it's required.
It is, yeah. Let's face it, without multinational cooperation, CERN would not be in operation. We would not have the LHC up and running. That depends so much on not just French and Swiss cooperation, on scientists from all over the world. Everybody there is on the same level, and it sets the pace, perhaps.
No country is putting out enough scientists on their own.
No, we're not anymore.
In any no, you can't put out enough of your own scientists for your own specialties. Stuff is changing so fast.
Yeah. It used to be that you would set up a project in your own national boundaries, you would staff it with your own people, mm-hmm. and that would be it. And that would be the end of it.
You know what changed all that? Supernova 1987A.
Yeah.
That changed it. Scott Mann sent me a video of it, and I went and looked it over. And you could see how that supernova, 1987A, if they had worked stronger together, it would have been better. But it was the fact that they weren't working as strongly together that they changed, and they just made it work.
Yeah.
Made science more collaborative, more international, and... Different systems, different countries have to be ready. Like these gravitational waves, you need instrumentation from every country that can point.
We
LIGOs. How many of them are getting LIGOs now? Germany, France, they got one.
I think China's got one as well. The Americans have got one. Here in America, there is one. The European Space Agency, along with NASA, are working on putting one in orbit. That is going to be the bee's knees. The fact we're actually going to have a platform in space, and it will actually be completely clear of things like a 16-wheeler going by, and having to calibrate for said 16 wheeler.
Oh yeah, there'd be lots of that. But the funny part was, is I had a guess that they would have we'd detect gravity waves by 2018, and I said I would really like to see them in 2016 to go with Einstein's, and they came in. I was excited about that, and by the people who did it, I really wanted to see that interferometer work. I was really, really happy with it.
I want to see LISA or LIGO launched. I want it in operation. Because you know what? That in itself will help us understand what is going on. We have detected the mergings of neutron stars or black holes. It will even, it's the best bit about it.
Why are the black holes so big, though? Ooh, there's the new big question. Why are they so big?
And also the other question, of course, is the primordial, thank you, black holes.
Why are they so big? How did they get so big? And how did they find each other so soon? Because the universe is not old enough. That's the big one. Could be a chemical relationship. See, all this stuff, for the people who are listening, you notice we're talking about stuff years ago. Your first hint should be, like, these guys have been reading too much too long. But that's just it. Some of the stuff that we had and we promoted and we really enjoyed watching come along has come true, and it's either succeeded or it's been changed or didn't really get the answers everybody was looking for. But that's what science is. It's a complete journey. It's not once you get the result, it's over. When you're doing what we're doing here and we're just experiencing the complete field of it, it's exciting.
Yeah.
Try not to get your heart too much into something, because it's going to get broken, because people have feelings. And that's why I said, when it comes to this supersymmetry and how it's changed a lot of things, you know, there's a lot of feelings, there's a lot of degrees, there's a lot of PhDs tied up in it. But it's still going to stick around, because you need that conversation that blends all these subjects. It's like geometric interpretation of linear algebra. It brings together all the STEM ones, right? Because you got like computer scientists and physicists and mathematicians. Everybody has different, you went and put up the equation. Everybody has different equations. And yet they're actually talking about the same thing in a geometric algebraic relationship. And once you learn a geometric interpretation of it, like a triangle, and you can see how the equations work for other fields, it's like, okay. And it gives you a common language amongst all these different disciplines to have a conversation. It doesn't make you any better in any one subject in particular. It makes you more knowledgeable about all the subjects just by being able to have a conversation. And that's where this new field of conversations is at. It's emergent. It's new.
Yeah, they've broken the mold of everybody being in their little niches.
No, and instead, you bring everybody together now.
Yeah, exactly. And because everybody's talking from their point of view, things are merging, things are being discovered. Because people are talking.
You facilitate these cross-platform conversations. And you bring these people together for like 6 weeks at a time, and now you're bringing together relatable tools.
Mm-hmm.
And these funny words like mock modular forms and automorphic forms, oddly enough, they're the new relatable terms. And they deal with the representation theory. You know, in math, these are hard subjects on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. But just to understand how they form in a conversation, no, they're not. And they're really unique things to follow. And they've been around since Ramanujan. Ramanujan discovered these things. The Man Who Knew Infinity, that was just out at the movies. There's one of India's most famous, if not the most famous. Worked with Harding, G.H. Harding.
Yeah.
Amazing individual. Now his math, he wrote some math, and now today, these past couple of years, people have been looking at it and go, wow, these are mock modular forms. And they have this other thing in the computers now called neural networks.
Yeah.
They weren't that great, say, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, people ignored them. But about 3 years ago, they started to make a little bit of a breakthrough. These neural networks are computer programs, algorithms. And here's a prediction I'm going to make. Within 10 years, some kid, high school kid, is going to discover something about the universe.
Yeah.
With his own, using his own neural network that he has in his bedroom. And he's going to win a Nobel Prize for discovering something really unique about the universe that showed up, that he found using his neural network. Because of all the data that's coming in on these big astrophysical projects now, these neural networks are just thriving for data.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to find some kid's going to put something together. Because right now you got a high school kid putting them together and finding cures for cancer. That's how powerful these new tools are. They're also scary. But you take this high school girl right now. She went and she designed her neural network with her own computer. And it can diagnose cancers of this certain types of samples at 99.7% accuracy.
That is scary. Yeah.
I know. Her first attempts were all failures. She couldn't get her system to work. She kept at it, and she's up to that now.
Isn't that that's the whole point? Just because you have a failure, you don't stop. You look at it, you examine it. Where did it go wrong? What worked? What didn't work?
But check out Google Deep Dream.
Yeah.
Microsoft has them too. These systems now, about 3 years ago, they can start to identify dogs. They use pictures. They can tell a dog. They can go through every picture on the internet and pick out all the dogs. A computer program. Mm. It can pick out the cats. It can tell the difference between a Chihuahua and a St. Bernard. They can pick out about 1,000 different things. And like Alan Turing. It goes back to Alan Turing. You know Alan Turing, Bletchley Park,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
He dreamed of machines, a human brain. And this is based on neurons. And it's really, it's exciting, and it's also the most scariest technology I know exists. Because everybody talks about how their cell phone's getting so good at understanding them. Well, each cell phone has their own neural network of you.
Yeah.
And it's your own artificial AI you're promoting. And this is what, you know, because some people are saying, be careful of the technology. This is one of the technologies they're saying, you know, be careful of. It's powerful.
Now, I know, I think I remember seeing that Samsung is using neural nets in their latest. I think
Everybody has. They're here. There's no way you're pulling them back. You can't. They're using finance now. They're working.
Yeah.
It is actually scary that a program can go through millions and millions of lines of code in just in less than 2 minutes and put out these diagnoses. What they really like to do is get their hands on password files. Not not bad guys, no. Say like you'll find this stuff on computer file, okay? So I'm not saying anything that's not already on the internet. In computer file, it's a YouTube channel. It goes with number file and rest them. They talk about getting the LinkedIn list. That's 50 million passwords. Now, they don't want your password, and they don't want to know anything about you. But what they want is that password list. It's because it's encrypted. And it's universities want them, and students want them, because they want to see how good their system is that they keep working on and adjusting their own nodes, how good it is at cracking that password list. And it's scary because even their basic ones are cracking 60% of the list on their first try. And the first try lasts less than 30 seconds. See, these computers you have now with these video cards, in the year 2000, for real, it had a building cost $160 million for a computer, plus a building, plus the air, plus the energy. A $1,000 video card from NVIDIA now covers the same processing as that $160 million supercomputer running Windows Server 2000 in the year 2000. That's only 16 years. Yeah. That's how fast something has changed in the last 3 years. And you put four of them in your machine, and there's not much you can't crack. All you really want now is data, more data.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes your machine smarter.
Yeah.
And of course, they're used for finance. Yeah.
And they have scary programs like Cortina for Windows 10, Siri.
There's no password. If you got a password, it's no good. If you got a password, it's no good. Don't use your same password you use at Amazon as you use for Facebook or Twitter or any of them. That's just common sense now. Yeah. Leave your Google password with Google. Leave your Facebook password with Facebook, okay? But don't use the same password all over the same place, especially not like at an Amazon account. If you have an Amazon account, have an Amazon password, okay? Just for there. Nobody's going to steal your password from there, okay? It can take care of. It's where your password gets stolen from these other sites you belong to that you were too, you couldn't think of a password, so you just have the same password for all your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the sites that get hacked. Then the bad guys get a hold of those lists and they go, well, I wonder if they have if they have an Amazon account or if they have a Facebook. And sure enough, they just run it. You just run through a program and they open up all these accounts. And that's how your Facebook account gets broken into. They didn't get in through Facebook. They got in through some weak area where you keep using the same password. So if you use Finance, just have a password just for Finance.
Mm-hmm.
Like on your Amazon one. Because there is no secure passwords on the internet right now. Okay, that's just a fact check. These things are crazy now.
I know, and I used to think that having a 14-digit password was fun.
No.
Not really.
If it's, if you have a password that's in a, that can be found in a dictionary.
No, I used to use a random generator.
No, they're no good. I'm trying to tell you, they're toast too. Even the email, even the files they put the passwords in that are encrypted,
yeah,
are crackable. That's how fast stuff has been changed. And so when they say change your passwords, change your passwords. It's for real. Do not have the same password for everything. If you have a financial transaction place, just leave the password only for there. Don't use it anyplace else. Use something stupid that's easy to crack on your Facebook or something. Who cares? It's your Facebook. Mm. But you're not going to break any Facebook passwords by picking on Facebook. They're going to get it through these other sites you belong to.
Well, if you're listening, folks, take heed because it's true enough. If you use the same password everywhere, you will well and truly get beaten.
Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah. Because when they get the bad list, they just run these passwords through everything. Everything that has an account. And that's how they open up stuff.
That's why a lot of places at work now, they tell you, you can't use the same password twice or even literally change a couple of digits because it's too easy for a computer program just to go through all the combinations quicker.
I can't even begin to tell you the scariness how fast these things open.
Right. What was you had another story you wanted to
But you're going to be using this for good. We're talking about for good.
Yeah.
And you're going to take stuff like Galaxy Zoos and Moon Zoos, that's why you might be finding them missing a little bit. They want them so they can run their algorithms. They're going to be designing algorithms to find astrophysical objects. That's where the really good work's going to be. All this data that's coming back, it's coming back from these large systems, and we're talking terabytes of data coming down. There's systems, they need these systems and these algorithms now to be able to go through them. So it's, all that stuff's good. You know, there's like bad guys in the world, so you've got to be careful, I guess.
And, of course, there's the petabytes of stuff sitting there waiting to be examined already.
And one of the biggest are going to have fun with.
Yeah. The institutions that run the radio telescopes, the optical telescopes, they are finding that the biggest problem they have is number crunching. That's why things like the bionic program has soared, because instead of having one university computer sit there and go through every single file, which would take millennia, they can farm bits of data out to hundreds of thousands of computers worldwide, have you crunch it, report it, and then they can just assemble the whole picture.
Because they're numbers. Nobody wants to use CPUs anymore. That's why they use the video.
Yeah. So, of course, if you've got a good GPU, or you have got a cracking good card in your computer, consider taking part.
Because that's where the amateur astronomers coming from in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
It's going to be people like doing these surveys at home. Yeah. They're going to have their own system. You're going to be reading about high school kid finds this using his own neural network at home. Yeah, that's all cool. So the only thing those kids are missing is the general conversation that we'd said we're old. We've been here a while. This is a conversation we need to be able to share with them. That's all. Share a conversation so they'll have ideas about where else to search and check.
Maybe one of the things for the perhaps the very near future will be that the high schools and the middle schools are taking part in conversations with the universities. They're talking to the people doing the research, and they're going away, have their own little conversation, and then coming back to the main conversation. So this is what we found, this is what we think, and putting it in there. Black Projects have just pointed out that the zoites are detecting supernovas again. This is all by having a conversation, whether it's sitting there looking at thousands of pictures, or if you're looking number crunching with Bionic, it's having that conversation. It's saying, we're going to do this, we're going to be part of it. And the best part of being a part of it is, at the end of the day, you have perhaps taken the sum of human knowledge a step forward. And I can see a point in time where most amateur astronomers may well have their own pan-stars, their own synoptic survey in their own garden, or maybe they're going to get together as a group, buy a field, put it in, and monitor it, and they're going to be finding the comets, the near-Earth objects, the supernovae, and they'll be the ones who will be getting their names on the reports. It's not far off. The technology is available. We have very good, fast telescopes at home now. We can build a survey. We have people who can do the computer side of it, do the software side of it. How long? 10 years, I think, before some enterprising astronomy club sets up their own automated survey and starts challenging the big boys. It isn't going to be the big boys for very much longer. It's going to be everybody. And when that finally happens, it's going to be the next step forward, because it's no longer, it's pan-stars, it's the synoptic, it's hum-ha.
Well, they're going to be going after this data because it's a collection of data they can play with. That's going to be one of the biggest draws for it. It's a collection of data that, you know, their systems can get a hold of, and it's being offered to them.
I think if quantum computing proves to be successful, but also kicking as a next step, we'll have the machine. You'll have your own home supercomputer, pretty much. And then the sky is not just the limit, it's the beginning. You've got a whole universe to take part in and discover.
We've got quantum neural networks now.
Yeah.
That's shit scary. These are mimicking neurons in the brain. These are computers that are thinking and learning on their own. If that doesn't wake you up and freak you out and scare you, I haven't been speaking well enough.
It's Skynet. The beginnings of. You remember that film.
It's exciting, and it's pretty weird.
Yeah, I think the thing is, we are living in auspicious times. We are taking large steps. We are doing things that perhaps weren't even dreamt of by people like H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, Isaac Asimov.
No one could dream of this here because they didn't think they'd get this to work.
So. And you know what?
Anyway, I hope we had fun tonight. We're down to 30 seconds, Dick. We got to run.
Yeah, we are. No, it's been fun. It just
shows
you
how shows coming up next too, bud. Yeah.
Yeah, we got two talking spaces, two new ones as well.
New ones.
Yeah.
It's been fun, Nick.
It has been fun, John. It's always fun when we get together. We always do what we set out to do on a Friday night,
and that's take over the world and let it go.
Okay, well,
always a pleasure, folks. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for turning up.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website, It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts. AFM.